excuses. The center has to be at least 3 times bigger than this.
LGBTQ.
Dave Radio, Fridays at noon on CITR.
Wow, wow, Dave, you're so sway. Oh, Dave, I like your shave.
And we're the Daves. I'm David Bedenik.
I'm Dave Campbell.
I'm Dave Frank.
We're the Daves.
And you're listening to CITR FM 101.9.
CITR Radio.
And these are the Daves of our lives.
Friday, the 10th of April, 2020, and this is Dave Radio with Radio Dave on the radio. We are broadcasting live on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming on the World Wide Web at CITR.ca from an undisclosed location somewhere on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. On the program today, well, it's week 4 of the new reality. How are you holding up? We are in the midst of preparing to move, because as I mentioned last week, our suite was put on the market just before the lockdown happened. And I tell you, if you've never tried to move in the midst of a global pandemic, well, you haven't lived. It's the Radio for Shut-Ins version of Vancouver's go-to hour for local independent theater, film, and music, and it starts right now. Don't touch that dial. Well, there's a bit of news on the theater front. Mostly sad news, as our summer theater events are announcing their closures. Bart on the Beach won't be happening this year. Neither will Ensemble Theater. And we just got word that the TD Jazz Festival is canceled for this year. Who knows? We haven't heard from the Fringe yet. Who knows what they're going to do? And we also lost one of our great characters from our theater community, Mr. Tom Kerr. Tom was a director, teacher, and mentor to many of our friends. He passed away at the age of 90 after dealing for many years with the pain and disability of spinal stenosis. Tom often directed at the Arts Club and the Playhouse, and he was the founding artistic director of Western Canada Theatre in Kamloops. So a lot of us owe a lot to Tom. In lieu of flowers, his partner of 42 years, Glenn Carnes, has requested that we make donations in Tom's name to AFC, which is the Actors Fund of Canada. And you can find that on Canada Helps. .org. But there's happy news too. Theater Under the Gun is still happening, but rather than being at Performance Works, it's going to be online. So the rules are the same. It's Theater Under the Gun. 6 theater companies get an inspiration package and have just 48 hours to create an original piece of theater. But what does theater look like when the performers and audience are all isolated at home? Here's your chance to find out. Their 10-minute plays will be presented via live stream on the 21st of April. You can get tickets at theaterwire.com, and tickets are pay what you can, but there's also a free ticket option if you need that as well. So don't let the cost of it get in the way of you enjoying it, but if you can afford to throw some bucks their way, they'd really appreciate it. And we appreciate the folks at Theatre Wire and Colin Thomas's Fresh Sheet for doing a much better reporting job than I am, keeping us in the know on theatre happenings and not happenings in these wacky times. So thanks for doing all the hard work for us. Anyway, on with the show. This week we've got part 2 of Chris King's interview with Bill Millard, the former artistic director of the Arts Club Theatre Company. And this is from his podcast, From the Pit. We're very grateful for him to let us play it here. Now, we pick up from where we left off from last week with Chris asking Bill a somewhat provocative question.
Why do you think the Arts Club is successful? I mean, that may be a larger question, but then you'd be able to answer. But what do you think in the early days, like when you decided to move to Granville Island, that seemed like a very good choice at the time. Like, how did that all come about? Was it just timing?
Well, a lot of people thought it was a stupid choice because Gastown had been considered such a hole that they thought Granville Island was going to be just the same. And this was people on our board. The board was actually split right down the middle to do the move to Granville Island. And the chairman at the time voted to do it and broke the tie. Granville Island was, it really started with my dad. He, by then the fishing industry had really changed. So this is sort of late 70s. And he had, where the hotel is now, the Granville Island Hotel, he had a little shack, I guess you'd call it. And he had sold the land where the cannery was. He'd sold it to the fisheries department to become a fisheries research place. And but he continued to run the company. He had a fleet of fishermen mainly that would bring him the fish or packers that he knew. And then he would outsource, of course, the canning of the fish. So he started to hear. He was also connected to the Liberal Party, mm-hmm. and the Federal Liberals, which is why I think he was able to make the why he was so passionate about the cannery itself. Becoming something. He was very interested in fisheries research, and he found it very difficult to deal with the depleting stocks and that kind of thing. So anyways, he told me. So I'm only just a few years into thinking I could do this job at Seymour Street. He said, the federal government is buying up leases on Granville Island, and he said, I think they're interested in developing the land, and I was trying to find a place to build our sets because we started to run almost year round, so we couldn't build the sets on stage anymore. Mm-hmm. And so he said, there's various warehouses that you probably could just squat in. And so he introduced me to the gentleman who was kind of dealing with buying up the leases, and he said, yeah. Why don't you use building whatever it was called, building 52 or something, which is where the shop is today, still today.
Amazing.
And he said, yeah, just use it. You'll have to patch it up. You'll have to heat it. You'll have to, we'll lease it to you for $1 a year. Just squat there. And then another building came available, and he said, why don't you, because I needed some offices for designers and the production manager. We had no room at Seymour Street. He said, oh, well, you can use that, which is now right across the street. It's used by one of the craft people down mm-hmm. here on the island. So anyways, and then this development did take hold, and a whole master plan that Norm Hodson, Bakker Hodson architects were involved in. And they had this mixture that they wanted to see, and it included theaters, live performance spaces. Mm. And they were open to, they opened it up to a competition. So we entered, and this building, the Grandmont, that's now the Grandmont stage, we targeted, which was an old chain and forge warehouse, and we targeted what was the review stage right across the lane. For a cabaret, and so we put in our bid, mm-hmm. We were very fortunate to be granted the spaces, and that was really talking about transformative. Suddenly, we've gone from this 200 seat theater into 450 seats, and we were very fortunate. And again, it was an era where there was lots of public money. You know, we got at that time a huge amount, which was $1 million from the feds, and the province matched it. And then we raised the rest. And so that's how we got it. And that, and as I said, I think I was led to do this because, well, first of all, I had these people working with me that were earning nothing. And I was so afraid that I was going to lose them. Yeah. And these are very talented, mainly designers, but also actors. Yeah. You know, actors were starting to leave Vancouver to go to Toronto or, you know, like in Michael J. Fox's case, mm-hmm. go south to L.A. So I was really conscious that if we were going to keep going as a company, we couldn't continue to exist in a 200-seat theater. We just couldn't pay enough. And so I was interested in okay, let's see if we can get a bigger space in an old warehouse. Sounded, you know, sounded a bit like Mickey and Junie putting on a show. But so that that again, I think was the major step forward in changing the focus of the company.
And of course, you've moved to. The offices have moved to the BMO space. And you also, through this dynamic, how did you get involved with the Stanley Theater? Because obviously it was sitting dormant for a while. And then was it Industrial Alliance that came to you, or did you decide that you wanted to redo that space?
Well, it's another wonderful story and another, you know, in the evolution of the company. So we lost Seymour Street in 91, and it became a kind of obsession of mine to replace it somewhere. And so, you know, I would trot around town and look at, you know, empty spaces and could we lease that or could we buy that or what, you know. So now we're down to, not down to, but we're running the Gramelin stage and we're running the review stage. And you know, you would think, well, that's enough. Why? But the review stage was originally a cabaret,
right?
And but I really wanted a space devoted to new and edgier, experimental, whatever work. And the review was very much more sort of, you know, with cabaret music reviews. You know, a form that I'm very interested in. Focus. And theater sports, so the Stanley also closed in 91. And the city, in their wisdom, through a public campaign that was called Save the Stanley, then passed a bylaw, or whatever you would call it, that the space could not be, had to be maintained for public use. Mm. Because Gap, I think it was Gap, was interested in buying it and turning into a store because of South Granville, retail mm-hmm. focus. And so the city agreed to save the stand. They didn't buy it or anything, but they forced the owners, which was Paramount Pictures, to look at if they did sell it, they had to sell it to... Or if they leased it, they had to lease it to somebody who would be operating it with the public interest. They could operate it as a movie theater, of course. Although I think there might have been a caveat about that, that it couldn't be run by a theater chain that would be in competition with Famous Players,
right?
Which was the wing, the Canadian wing of Paramount Pictures that you know exhibited films. And Theatre Sports, Vancouver Theatre Sports League, started to look at it because they had lost their space downtown. And so they needed a space, so they started to look at it. But, of course, this is a 700-seat movie theatre and with no seats. And so they were not really interested in doing that. And I happened to run into Mark Speck, who was the administrator there, and started to talk to her about it, and we started to fantasize whether we could twin it, and Theatre Sports would have the upstairs, and we would have the downstairs. And my thought was we would move the cabaret to the Stanley, and the review stage would then be converted into this Seymour Street-type you know, incubator for new work. And so Astounding Theater Society was formed in the mid-90s. And we set out to buy it, and Astounding Theater Society negotiated to purchase the theater from Paramount. And we had to borrow money, obviously, to do that, and embarked on a campaign to raise what was then $7 million to purchase and renovate it. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it was back then. And the first bit of good luck is that Chrétien, when he got elected, introduced a kind of infrastructure program, which we qualified for. So a third of the $7 million could come from the feds. We didn't get a matching from the province, but very close. So we then had two-thirds. We then were able to sell the air rights to the Wall Center. That helped to raise a good portion of it. But by that time, the construction costs, plus including the purchase, had risen to over $9 million. Mm. And we only set out to raise $7 million. So it was decided that we would, before we started construction, or the design process, that we would keep it as one theater, and the Arts Club would run it, and Theater Sports would on a good basis rent the review stage. So the review stage became Theater Sports' home, and the Arts Club undertook to design and renovate the Stanley Theater, which we opened in '98. So again, you know, setting out not necessarily to have a theater that was 650 seats. And of course, at the end of the day, I still didn't have, I had lost the incubator stage. So I'd gained something and lost something else.
Yeah.
Eventually when Theater Sports was able to get their space on Granville Island here at the entrance to the island, they were able to get their own space. So we took back the review stage in 2010. Mm-hmm. And so finally I had this incubator space.
Well, I can't believe the Stanley, it's 1998.
Yeah.
So it's already 20 years old this year.
I know. Yeah.
It seems sort of like yesterday in my mind that the campaign was happening. That's so great. How has Vancouver theater changed now from the time when you started at the Arts Club?
Well, certainly from starting when I first got involved with the Playhouse, there was the Playhouse, there was the Arts Club, which had really basically, it started in 64. This is now when I came back was 68. And there was a professional company at UBC in the theater department. It didn't last very long, but there were professional actors hired at UBC. Until really, I guess when Brockington left and they changed their focus to have students in the productions as opposed to professional actors, and that was the ecology. There was the odd touring professional company like the Canadian Players, but that wasn't a regular thing. I think the 70s, really, like you mentioned it, was a time of extraordinary growth. Tamanu's Theatre was formed. The Vancouver East Cultural Centre opened, I think, in 75, so that was major. A number of young people's companies like Carousel and Green Thumb and Axis Theatre started up. So a real spur of activity of people my age or younger who came out of UBC, and then Studio 58, of course, started. So there were those graduates. And going into theater was something that people thought that's possible to do. The television and film industry started up. So that's helping actors stay in Vancouver and not consider leaving. And I think that that early growth persisted right through until I would think the mid-80s. And then it kind of leveled off for a decade when things became tough. You know, we lost time, and it was, City Stage started also in that time, the Lunch Hour Theater. And there were other companies, you know, like co-ops and various things, and probably at some point the Fringe started. And Gravelon itself, because the Waterfront Theater, which is Carousel Youth, the new Play Center used, which also started up, and a company called West Coast Actors, which was classically based, also was formed. And so it was a going concern at the Waterfront Theater, plus ourselves. And that kind of stabilized, as I say, into the 90s. And then about the mid-90s, we started groups like the Electric Company Theater, Boca de Lupo, other more artist-driven companies started, Ruby Slippers, probably, you know, maybe predating that was some of the other companies like Pi, Rumble, that kind of thing. And so there was another flurry. And now I think we see, again, I think, and also Fire Hall Theater Center opened, and Studio 16. So there are places for people that can perform. Performance Works opens up. So that's very important for people being able to. And you know, there was more money. Well, in the last 10 years, I would say things again have leveled off. The money has definitely not increased at the same level. Canada Council was frozen for a long time. The BC Arts Council has never really. I believe the current government is putting more money into it, but we haven't really seen it yet. So that kind of thing has forced companies to do less. So instead of, obviously Touchstone. Touchstone started, they probably, started in the early 80s as well. So those companies are just, you know, just getting by, as it were. And then, of course, we lost the playoffs in 2012. So I think today it's a time of, there's lots of companies, over 60, but it's a time of really assessing where we're at. I think the Arts Club and of course Bart and the Beach started in the early 90s. So and it's you know, now well established. So so there's Bart and ourselves at a certain level of activity, and then there's a lot of companies in not necessarily the mid level, but maybe lower mid, and then a lot of sort of co-ops and smaller companies and companies that find, you know, garages to perform in. And so the ecology maybe needs to have one of those companies. Like for a while we thought Touchstone would be it in a kind of middle range. On the other hand, I don't think it's necessary as long as the opportunities are there for people to do the work. And really a lot of it is supported by the film and television, because the actors are able to, you know, think of having a living,
right,
and then maybe do one or two plays a year. I think the biggest threat is to the musical theater side, because depending on what Ashley Corcoran does here at the Arts Club, you know, I obviously pushed to do big musicals and once the Stanley opened, and try and encourage musical theater talent, and Cap College now has a really good program, and producing some excellent students, but keeping them here, that I see a lot of them leaving, going back east, obviously, where there's a lot of opportunity. But then there's a lot of young people coming up, and of course we can always, you know, bring talents back. So that's a bit of a concern of mine. But but you know, I'm sure it'll sort itself out.
Musicals or plays, which one do you like more?
Well, I did a lot of plays when I started. Didn't really think about doing musicals, obviously, at Seymour Street, not being big enough. We did some musical reviews, but I never considered myself a particularly musical director. I'm not a choreographer. But, you know, I had a music background and interest in music. And then when we got to Granville Island, I thought, well, maybe I'll try my hand at it. And started working with people like Bruce Kellett as a musical director, and some extraordinary talents like Jeff Hislop, and I mentioned Ruth Nickel when we did Pippin, which was the first musical we did here, and then carried on from there. And then, you know, I encouraged others, Dean Regan, who is a kind of director, choreographer, wonderful, and he created a lot of wonderful shows for us, Red Rock Diner and Black and Gold Review and such. But then when we got to Stanley, and it started to I started to get inspired by the theater itself, built in 1930, and look at some of the, you know, really classic musicals like My Fair Lady and West Side Story, and then was very fortunate to start working with Valerie Easton. Who really Bruce sort of promoted me getting to know her, because I had been working with others, and it really was working with her and how we got along that I realized, well, I'm not a choreographer, and I don't have to be a choreographer as long as I understand what I'm looking for in actually staging a musical. And so I got very interested in it and started then doing less plays, partly because of the challenge of actually running the company. And even though by then we had a general manager, I still had a lot of time. You know, I continued to do the negotiating and dealing with rights and that kind of thing, and building the company up to be solid. So, and musicals was a form that, you know, I could all do both jobs at the same time directing, whereas plays, you really, you know, you have to be totally 100% focused on the play. I kind of miss that, but you know, I did a lot of work at a time where that made sense in the kind of way the company was growing. I wouldn't say I would choose one over the other. So I think there's something about a musical that really, you know, can transport an audience of all ages and all demographics in a way that a play can't necessarily. And some of the great experiences, like doing Miss Saigon or Les Misérables or even Once, which I just did this summer, that, you know, really does take an audience in a kind of different direction that I think is that's kind of neat to watch.
And I know you've handed the company off. Of course, Ashley Corcoran has come in, but you're going to maintain an office here. Is it bittersweet?
Well, because Once opened in, I stepped away officially from the job in the middle of May. Ashley started full time end of February, beginning of March, and I carried on while, you know, the transition that the board felt was necessary, and then a producer person was hired the middle of May, which is when I really left. And I've spent some time since then really helping the producer person who's doing the negotiating and all that admin side of it that I did, that Ashley, you know, wisely is not going to do. And so really the summer has been back and forth. It's been a kind of quasi-retirement, as it were. But tonight, or at least this date of... September 12th, Ashley opens her season. So that really is a good transition. And then, you know, I'm going to be away for a couple of weeks. So I think it'll be much more of an opportunity for me to really understand what retirement means. It's great that the company has allowed me to have this office at Granville Island. Of course, they've dumped all the stuff from all my other various offices into it, so I can barely open the door. So I'll spend a lot of time sorting through that, because there's obviously a lot of stuff and memories and you know, literally paper that I should just shred. So it's probably too early to know, you know, ask me in a year and I'll really be able to reflect on what it's like being given a lot of advice, people telling me, you know, what you expect in retirement or don't expect. And so it's one of the interesting things, like somebody said to me, well, you know, you probably should focus on something. You know, don't make a dramatic decision, like, you know, don't sell your house and move, or, you know, we have a place on Demon Island, so that's a great retreat place to go. But I decided to relearn the piano. So I was a pianist, or a studied piano, and at one point, you know, thought about being a concert pianist. Until my piano teacher was a well-regarded teacher and well-regarded a Vancouver pianist, you know, did a lot of sort of concerts in the city himself, said to me, well, you know, Mr. Millard, I think I'm in university now. I think you will be an excellent piano teacher. And so clearly I was not going to be a concert pianist. And that was fine, because, you know, now I'm at UBC and got other interests, and so I really dropped it. But obviously, you know, with doing musicals and one thing or another, kept a very strong interest in music. And occasionally when I would, you know, be at home trying to figure out a score or whatever, I'd sit down at the piano and kind of pick away at what it was. But anyways, I decided, well, okay, I've got time. I'll start to play the piano. So I asked the musical director, Ken Cormier, you know, how do I get back? How do I start again? I don't, you know, all the music I had before is gone, and, you know, basically have very little. And so he told me about an exercise book that I should get. And so, as it turns out, somebody had already sent it to me, thinking that, you know, if you're going to get back on the piano, this is what you should use. So I've started exercises at the piano and sight reading, which, you know, I could sight read. So, but, you know, suddenly sight reading, sitting at the piano, it's great. So apart from that, you know, I still haven't really gone into the rhythm of what it is like not to go to the office. But every once in a while I get called up and say, well, can you come into a meeting or do this or that or the other? And I have to really think through the process of actually, oh, okay, I got to put on a set of clothes and go to work.
Actually get there. So I was going to ask my last question was, what's next? But I guess concert pianist is in your future, is it? Going to get back on the piano horse, as they say.
I think travel. I've always enjoyed traveling and seeing theater, you know, and wherever I go. I have family. My brother and his family live in Waterloo, Kitchener, so they're back east. You know, and as I say, I mentioned the place on Demon. It's amazing when you have time to read that you actually read. You know, I never read novels because I read so many plays. And that was quite getting used to that. Every summer, I would start reading all the plays in planning the next season. And so, you know, this summer I wasn't reading plays, which was interesting. I thought of one thing that somebody mentioned to me. John Wright, actually, you know, he got the Career Achievement Award at the Jessies, and we were talking, and he said, you know, you would be the person to really write about theater in Vancouver. I mean, there are others who are equally, if not more, qualified. But having lived through it, you know, not necessarily the history of the Arts Club, but, you know, just like what we've talked about, mm-hmm. what, you know, what has it been like to see that growth in the 50 years, mm-hmm. the 50-plus years that... the 60 years or whatever from when the Playhouse started and really professional theater became a reality in this community. And of course, you know, we've already lost some of the key players like Joy Calkill, mm-hmm. Without sitting down and hopefully maybe somebody interviewed her, I don't know. But looking into that, I think would be a good activity.
What are you the most proud of?
I think, first of all, leaving a legacy of the buildings, a legacy of a company that's solid, handing over to Ashley, you know, it's on very, very strong footings. She can dream. She can you know, she can fail in whatever way. I don't think she will, but, you know, giving her that opportunity to take risks. So the fact that the company is on a solid footing. And then the facilities themselves. I mean, we own the Sanity Theatre. We do have a long-term lease here at the Grand Line Stage, so hopefully we won't we'll be able to renew that. And, of course, we have a long-term lease at BMO. I think... You know, that was because honestly, I thought of retiring several times. And it was really the drive to realize what the production manager, Stefan Bommel, said to me 5 or 6 years ago. He said, you know, we need to move our costume shop. We're bursting at the seams in the shop building. And so we first of all looked here at Granville Island, but also I wanted to find a large rehearsal hall. The rehearsal hall upstairs here at Granville Island was never meant for the Stanley, of course, or big musicals. And it's extraordinary that we did some of the ones we did, like Les Mis with 24 people in that small space. And so combining that, as I say, we first looked at Granville Island and then... unfortunately, when the Playhouse closed, that opportunity came up to take over what was going to be their production center. And although we had no intention, again, of moving the Revue stage, what is now the Goldcorp stage, removing it when that became possible, that then cemented that what was a long-term dream of having a space that could be flexible and do new work. So I think the combination of the company being in a very good place plus the facilities, I think, I'm proud of that, that is something that I'm leaving for the future generations.
How do you know personally when a show is successful for you?
Well, financially, it's pretty obvious. If you're selling tickets, you know, I think, success in you know, has many ways of defining it. One is artistic, clearly. Mm. Is it success artistically? It could be a success artistically and nobody attends it. Mm. That has nothing to do with its success from that point of view. Success commercially is or financially, you know, do we sell enough tickets is pretty straightforward. Mm. But you can tell both things. You start with the play or the musical itself. Okay, so it's really difficult to muck up a successful musical like Mamma Mia that's, you know, already proven itself to be a success. You'd really have to be determined to destroy it. Mm. So you know that I mean... Obviously, you want it to be a success in all levels, but the tunes are the tunes, and people are going to jump up and down no matter what you do with them. But then you have to make sure that you do honor the work. You know, you can't be facile about it. Yes, you do have to make sure you've got the best people that you can get to bring that particular work to the stage. Artistically is a different thing, like particularly with new work. And how do you judge it being a success? So from an artistic point of view, really, for me, it's a gut reaction. It honestly is an instinctive going to see a work for the first time and judging, does it work for me personally? Might not work for the person sitting beside me or anybody else for that matter. But and because it took me a long time to really understand what critics were looking at when they came and judged my work. And, you know, you can be very overly sensitive about what they were saying. Today, you know, we don't even have critics anymore, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We have some. We have some wonderful people that despite all the odds, continue to write and broadcast and blog and whatever. And I'm so grateful to them because the word has to get out there about work that people might not know about. I mean, the Arts Club is a massive marketing machine. So, and that was something, you know, I didn't mention, but in the early days, the Daphne Goldrick, which I talked about, we wrote this musical review that was a flop, but she was a great mentor to me in many ways. She was an actress that I met when I was the stage manager at the Playhouse. And she said, you know, one of the first people you should hire is a publicist. And so we hired Marlene Dixon, who really transformed the way we looked at making sure the world knew about plays at the Arts Club. Because who knew about the Arts Club? Nobody. Mm-hmm. Well, until Jacques Brel came along. But and then she could capitalize on that. And she was fierce in making sure, you know, she'd get as much free publicity as possible because we didn't have much money to advertise. So we could, if the show was good, and even if the critics poo-pooed it, we could overcome that, if you know, because eventually an audience would find it and make up their own minds. But I think, you know, to answer your question, I think it's really... from my point of view, just an instinctive response. And you know, over the years, I would go and see the first run of one of our productions and be able to give notes. And sometimes I would know that, I don't think this is going to make it. Mm-hmm. And other times, you would be able to say, you know, if you do this or you think about doing that, and depending on whether the director was open to those ideas, you know, and trusting an artist, you know, trusting that the artists that you hire are going to make the right choices, I think is you know, a large part of making sure that you're going to get what you want on stage.
And do you think that that's your strength?
I think it's one of them, yeah. I think, and also people used to say that, I had a really good eye for casting. Oh. That I'm a real believer in warmth on stage, and so again, an actor coming into an audition, if I felt something from them, I didn't need to know much about them. I mean, you know, some directors spend a lot of time trying to get to know the actor. That to me was not important. I didn't need to necessarily know who they were, but if they struck me as somebody who had warmth, then you know, again, casting them to me was a major part of making sure the show was going to be a success. Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for joining me today, Bill. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to my talk with Bill Millard. If you enjoyed this chat, please listen to more From the Pit podcasts, available on iTunes or at fromthepitpodcast.com. We're also looking for sponsorships. If you want to sponsor us or know someone who does, please contact us through our website or on our Facebook page so we can continue to bring you more episodes.
According to the BC Center for Disease Control, COVID-19 is transmitted through larger liquid droplets, like what's produced when you cough or sneeze, coming in contact with the eyes, nose, and/or throat. COVID-19 is not transmitted through airborne particles, or small particles floating in the air, or through skin contact. To avoid droplet transmission, wear a face mask if sick. Cover your coughs and sneezes in your elbow. Do not shake hands or high-five others. Wash your hands frequently and for 20 seconds. Do not share household items. Flush the toilet with the lid down. Practice general cleaning.
Now we're going to play a repeat of last month's interview that we did with Sloan Thompson, director of the play Revolt, She Said, Revolt Again. I picked this one to play again because not only does Sloan have an interesting story, but it's kind of historical document now. We get a sense of how much things have changed in just 4 weeks. Hello, Sloan.
Hello. Hi, how are
thanks
you?
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you are you're an MFA directing student.
That is correct.
Yeah. So how's that going?
It's really, really a fantastic opportunity. Yeah. It's a 2-year program, and the first year it's all about building skills, and the second year they really just let you go and give you free rein to experiment and try things. And I love the freedom and I love the support. It's a really great program.
How long have you been involved in theater?
Oh, there is a picture of me as a 3-year-old in a little pageant playing Sparkle the Star in our Christmas pageant. And since then, you couldn't keep me off the stage, first as an actor. And then I discovered my love of directing when I was a senior in high school. And it's been a lifelong passion.
Mm-hmm. But your degree's in sociology.
It is.
So what drew you to that?
So I have always been... When I was younger, it felt like torn between a real passion for social justice and a love of theater. And I sort of felt like, you know, is it responsible to be making art when there's so many more, like, I guess, quote unquote, productive things you could be doing? But as I've gotten older and I've gotten into directing, I've really realized that those things actually work so beautifully in tandem, that you can find shows that address really important issues, and you can use the stage as a platform to inspire people to be more empathetic and more understanding of other people. So with this show specifically, it was such an amazing opportunity to merge those two loves.
All right. Well, since you did a very nice segue, let's talk about this show specifically. It's got a provocative title.
It does.
Revolt, She Said, Revolt Again. Did I get it right?
Yes.
There.
3 periods.
Yeah. You have to separate it up. I know there's a note. Right there. Please note the periods in the name. So tell us about it. What's the story of the show? What's the revolt?
So it's a unique format.
Yeah.
In that it's not one linear singular narrative. It's a series of episodes that show a bunch of different men and women in different situations having to do with patriarchy and capitalism and how these systems affect people's lives in really intimate and surprising and also in some ways very predictable ways and how they choose to break out of the mold and how they respond to those things. And I think that it's one of the things that's so beautiful about the show is if you have a story that's just about one person, and I, believe me, I love a lot of plays that are about just one person, but it makes it just about that one character's experience, and you have that emotional connection, but it's harder to then extrapolate that to a larger group of people.
Yeah.
But with this one, you at the end of the show, you step back, and there's this brilliant cross-section of experience that shows... That can really be applied to everyone and everything, and
if you're seeing the same patterns happening in all kinds of different situations, then you realize that this is prevalent. This is ubiquitous.
It really is.
You know, this is the world we live in.
Yeah. And so you know, it addresses the way that couples talk to each other in sexual situations. It addresses how people decide if they're going to get married or not and what marriage even means, how workplace harassment is handled, how people address issues of body shaming and body autonomy, and how the women in families specifically inherit trauma from each other, you know, how something can go from a grandmother to a mother to a daughter. And it's such a beautiful display of all different types of womanhood and all different types of situations.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a bit about your cast. They're all UBC theater students, right?
They are. They are all in the BFA acting program mm-hmm. here. There are 12 actors in this cast. There are 7 actors who identify as female and 5 actors who identify as male. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to have a diverse representation on stage as well. So it wasn't just me as a white woman, you know, casting exclusively white actors. We really wanted to open it up. And it's been such a joy to work with them. The original show that was done by the Royal Shakespeare Company in 2015 only had 4 actors. Mm-hmm. And UBC wanted to create as much opportunity as possible for the BFA actors, so they asked me to expand the cast, and we ended up with 12. And so what we were able to do with that is create an ensemble, mm-hmm. like a Greek chorus sort of, behind each scene, which really serves to emphasize certain points of the scene, to embody the sort of social pressures that people feel in those situations, to provide really interesting physical and visual dynamics to support the text. So the cast has been such a brilliant tool for the performance, as well as each and every one of them a brilliant performer.
Yeah, wonderful. So it's playing at the Freddie Woods.
It is.
And we were talking a little bit beforehand. Is you know, as times as they are right now, with all kinds of you know, cultural and social and events kind of shutting down, are there any specific precautions or things that are taking place at the theater around because of the virus?
Yes. So UBC has been so generous in allowing us to keep going, but they are capping our audience at 200 seats. It's a 400 mm-hmm. seat theater, so we're running right. at 50% occupancy, and it allows the audience, if they want to get some space from their fellow audience members and respect that social distancing. But it also gives the people the opportunity to see this, which I'm really, really grateful for. And you know, things like having hand sanitizer in the lobby. And last night at our gala, they prepackaged the reception food into compostable containers. And you know, so they really, really do have an eye on protecting the audience, keeping everyone safe, but still giving people an opportunity to see this wonderful show.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, a lot of work has been put into putting this thing together, and it's there for the audience to see it. So it's good that we're able to still get the audience out there to see it. Yeah. So you had your gala last night. It goes until the 28th.
Yes. If all things run as they are running right now, it will go to the 28th.
Mm-hmm. And you're doing a talkback show on the 18th.
Yes.
And tickets are available at UBCtheatertickets.com.
They are indeed. Yeah. And I would suggest, you know, go ahead and get them while they're hot.
Yeah.
The ticket, if you are a student, the ticket is only $11.50. So you really can't beat that for a night at the theater.
Yeah. Yeah. Terrific. And, you know, like they say, as events are slowly being chipped away from us, it's good to still latch onto things that are still happening. So,
yes.
And it sounds like just like a thought provocative, exciting and just, you know, great night of theater.
I think so. I'm biased, but I think so. You know, it's funny, it's moving, it'll make you laugh and cry, and you know, you get to see some really visually stunning things as well.
Yeah. We kind of get caught up sometimes in you know, message plays, and this is going to make me think, and I don't want to have to work. But you know, that's the thing about theater, is that it's also entertaining.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. I think that one thing that separates Alice Birch from some of the other radical feminist playwrights that are on the scene right now is how funny she is.
Yeah.
You know, she has this really wry, engaging humor that is able to break through this kind of like rage. And the rage is also present in the script, don't get me wrong. But it bounces you back and forth between feeling joyful and feeling devastated and feeling angry, and you really get the full spectrum of human emotions with this one.
Wonderful. Fantastic. And when do you complete your master's?
If all goes according to plan, I will graduate in May, and then I'll be off into the world. And
all right. Well, stay in touch. Let us know what you're up to, and good luck in all your endeavors. And
thank
everybody
you.
Go out, come to the Freddie Woods and see Revolt, She Said, Revolt Again. Sloan Thompson, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. And that's our show. Thanks for spending your lunch hour with us. One more time, thanks to Chris King for the use of the Bill Millard interview. And you can find Chris, all of Chris's interviews at FromThePitPodcast.com. If you missed any or all of today's show or want to relive glorious moments from the past, check out our podcast archive at CITR.ca. And you can also find us on Player.fm. And remember to subscribe and leave a comment on Apple Podcasts. Stick around. Audrey's up next with Too Dreamy, followed by Bepi Crespin Presents at 2 o'clock, and our very own star on the BC Entertainment Walk of Fame, Nardwuar the Human Serviette, at 3:30. Dave Radio will return next week at this same time. That's a promise. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
In the best of times. You can't change your mind. Not the world to me that you turn.